We're lucky enough to have an acclaimed Great Lakes historian and author, Michael Schumacher, joining us on the phone. Michael's an accomplished author. He's written several books about shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. His latest book, Torn in Two, talks about the sinking of the Daniel J. Morrill and the one man who survived the wreck. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Michael Schumacher. Well, Michael, you've written another gripping life and death page-turner about the gales in November. However, unlike your first book, The Mighty Fitz, the demise of the Daniel J. Morrill had an exceptional twist. There was one survivor, and his name was Dennis Hale. And if you could just quickly recap for our listeners what this man endured 50 years ago out on Lake Huron in Torn in Two. We've got Michael Schumacher back on the line talking about Torn in Two and the lone survivor, Dennis Hale. It was just too rough to hear you, Michael, but you were talking about Dennis and how he was mustered from the middle of the night in his underpants, if you want to pick the story up there.
Essentially, yes.
Okay.
And, well, he ended up on this raft wearing just a pair of boxer shorts, his life jacket, and a pea coat. And he was actually, well, he wasn't in really good shape, obviously. I mean, let's face it, it's November 29th. They're in the middle of a storm that just tore a boat in half. He's on a raft, but he was in better shape than at least one of the other guys who was on the raft who was awake and was plunged into the water, was wearing nothing but his pajamas. And at least he had a coat on or something. But what ended up happening, to make this long story short, was they roughed out the night. Two of the men on the raft died overnight from hypothermia. Another guy managed to survive, and Dennis. And by daybreak, they still didn't have any idea if anybody knew they were out there. So they just kind of, the storm was letting up. So it wasn't as bad as it had been during the night. But needless to say, nobody was sleeping on board that raft. The gentleman with him on the raft, who survived all through the day, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, says, "I see land." And Dennis is like, he's too weak at this point, really, to turn over on the raft to look for himself. But he had him describe it to him. And unfortunately, the guy that was with him on the raft died before they reached land. There was indeed land there. The raft was drifting toward it. Dennis ended up being caught up on some rocks about, 100 yards from shore. And he was too weak. The water was very shallow. It was only about knee-deep. But he was not able to walk, get off the raft or walk or do anything. There was a little house, like a farmhouse, in the near distance, and that didn't work because they couldn't hear him when he was calling for help. So he literally spent another night out on the lake, you know, in this terrible weather. The weather, when I say terrible, just when you think it can't get any worse for you, that you finally reach shore and you got a shot, it starts snowing. And so, you know, that was what he had to face all night, was this brutal weather. And, you know, as I point out in the book, nobody even reported the Morrill missing.
Yes.
Nobody even suspected anything was wrong. It had been in a storm. Boats were known to, you know, hide out behind islands and so forth, or just seek shelter anywhere, even in a port. And also, boats were known to lose their communications and stuff. So nobody thought anything of it until about noon the next day. The day after Dennis spent his last night on the lake, people started worrying about it. Now, they worried about it because the Morrill was out on the lake with its sister ship, the Townsend, which was also experiencing terrible difficulty. They were in the same area. They were going to the same place to pick up a load of iron ore. They were the same boat, essentially. The Townsend was a foot longer. That's how close they were. Well, he gets into, he sought shelter, the captain of the Townsend. he gets into port, and he checks out his boat, and there's a big crack appearing across the deck of his boat. So he's starting to worry. And in fact, that crack appeared in essentially the same place. It was, you know, one, what am I wanting to say here? It was essentially the same place.
Yeah.
So he contacted Cleveland, where the home office was, that asked if they'd heard from the Morrell, and no, they hadn't. Now he's starting to get real worried, and so were they. And what they did was they called the Coast Guard, and a tremendous search effort ensued. And eventually, I mean, I'm making this very short, but eventually they found Dennis's raft. A helicopter flying over saw it. It came down. They rescued him, and they took him to a hospital. A very small town. And so, you know, then the next part of this book, of course, is how does he survive that? I talked to, for example, the doctor who took care of him. He's very old now, but he remembered very well what happened that night. And he said he'd never seen anybody, you know, that close to death before in that condition. And they didn't even know how to treat him.
Well,
they had to call Detroit to get instructions as to how to treat somebody. He's, you know, a mess. He was hypothermia had set in. Part of him was frozen. It was a case like they'd never seen before.
How many hours did he spend on that raft in the
37.
Sea? 37 hours.
And he shivered so hard. Dennis was a pretty big guy.
Yeah.
And he lost 25 pounds shivering.
I can't believe that.
He lost 25 pounds. And the doctor, his opinion was that the extra weight probably saved his life.
Well,
because with the Bradley, the same thing happened. The two survivors of the Bradley were both big guys.
Hmm.
And, you know, so you got a little bit of extra to burn off or whatever. You know, I'm not a doctor. I couldn't say, but that was his opinion anyway.
Well, what struck me as profound was Dennis had a series of hallucinations out on the raft. Could you touch on that and what effect that had on him?
Well, it's really interesting you ask that question. Because I'm going to get back to the hallucinations in just a second. But when I talked to the doctor, he also has been a guy who's been studying the mind and the brain throughout his life. And he thinks that people don't give enough credit where it's due for what the mind can do to help the body, so to speak. In other words, he really believed that these hallucinations were largely a part of why Dennis is still alive today. The hallucinations, there were several. One of them involved his being lifted high into the sky over the raft, where he was looking down on the raft, and then he was whisked away to this land that really... it was like Nirvana or something. It was very green. It was very warm. And there, when he reached the land, he eventually was surprised to find here was the Morrell, the front part of it, the bow section of the Morrell, sitting there. And his friends were there, and he was overjoyed, you know, as you can imagine. And he was talking to us, and while he was talking, the back half of the Morrell came and joined it, and so there was the one big boat again, and all of his friends were there, and he thought, well, this is it, you know, I'm safe. And then one of the people, a guy from the engine room, told him, what are you doing here, Dennis? It's not your time. And he was taken back then in his hallucination to the raft and to reality and the terrible hardship that he was going through. He was going through so much that he alternately wanted to die and wanted to live. He didn't know what he wanted to do. But the other hallucinations I thought were interesting, too. At one point, he was so thirsty, he couldn't stand it. which is kind of funny to me. Here he is, one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the world, and he's thirsty. But this is what happened. He was too weak to actually get anything to drink. And so what he was doing was he was picking the ice off of his pea coat and sucking on it to get some moisture. And when he was doing this, all of a sudden, at the end of the raft, a man appeared, a bearded, older man, who told him, do not eat the ice. Do not eat that ice on your coat. And, of course, Dennis was, he didn't know what to think of this guy, other than the fact that he was scared to death of what was going on, and so he quit eating the ice. But a while later, he was still very, very thirsty, and he started doing it again, and the man appeared again and said, I told you, do not eat the ice. If you eat that ice, your body temperature will lower, and you will die, which is exactly what would have happened. But Dennis didn't know this. He to his dying day, he thought it was a miracle. He didn't know any of this.
It definitely was a
but
miracle.
They told him when he was brought in that that was very true, that he would have lowered his body temperature and he would have died.
Wow.
And with Dennis, he was a very, very religious man, a devout Roman Catholic. And when he told the priest that came to give him last rites, when he told him about this, the priest says, well, I wouldn't talk too much about that. I wouldn't tell anybody else about this. And it really disturbed him because he thought, if anybody would understand, it would be a spiritual man. And the priest just thought everybody would think he was nuts if he talked about it. So he didn't for many, many years. It wasn't until just fairly recently that he started talking about it.
Well, Dennis Hale, certainly a survivor's story. Torn in Two is the new book by Michael Schumacher. He joins us now on the Roadhouse. And an amazing tale of how one man survived the wreck of the Morrell, the Daniel J. Morrell, occurred on November 29th, was it 1966? So it's the 50th year anniversary of this wreck. This happened on Lake Huron. And there was quite an investigation into this wreck, wasn't there, Michael? You have a detailed report in the book, the Marine Board's findings. Mm-hmm. And what was the result of their findings?
Well, it's interesting because I included that because it's probably the most detailed Coast Guard report I've ever seen. And I've seen the one for the Edmund Fitzgerald, and it wasn't as long or as detailed as this one was. And I thought, you know, people don't know what these reports are like. Maybe it'd be nice if they got a look at one. What they kind of concluded, first of all, they concluded, you know, what they already knew, that the boat had broken in half due to structural failure. And then they started examining, well, why did it break in half? What failed? And, you know, again, you couldn't deny the evidence. In fact, the stern of the ship maintained full power and sailed on into the night, even after the people on the front part, the bow part, were in the water. And they found the stern about 5 miles away. It managed to stay afloat for an hour and a half.
Wow.
Yeah, they could tell because the clocks, when they hit the water, the clocks stopped. But in any event, they started studying things, and it made a big difference in some respects. First of all, they decided you can't have this ever happen again, or they can't send out an SOS. It can't happen. And so they required after that accident that from that point going forward, there would be battery-operated radios also on the boats. And it wasn't required at that time, but it was after. They also had a very intense examination of the iron or the metal or steel that was used to construct these ships. And what they found out, or what they already knew it to some extent, but what they concluded after this intensive study is that boats built prior to 1948 were made with a different kind of steel, a kind of steel that it was flexible, it had to be. But it became more brittle in very cold climate or cold water, cold air. And it made it possible for these boats to break in half. The Bradley had broken apart in 1958, so this was two major boats, the second and third largest to ever sink in Lake Michigan behind the Edmund Fitzgerald, that literally broke apart on the surface. And what ended up happening as a result of this was they had to make determinations. Their inspections changed a little bit so that they could determine whether or not these boats were seaworthy, after it got so cold. And some of them were, in fact, kept in, just weren't let out anymore after a certain point. The water and the temperatures, in other words, the Witch of November wasn't going to affect them anymore. But, the one thing that they didn't do was there was some talk of doing some safety features, adding safety features, such as these totally enclosed life rafts, where you would float. But you were totally enclosed. And there would be food supplies, and then there would be a radio in there, there would be flares, there would be all sorts of things. But you would not be out in the elements. And boats are using those, some of them anyway, today. But they did not. Nobody went along with it. Even though the Coast Guard encouraged it, neither the ship owners liked it, nor did the union for different, reasons. But, money was one of the big ones, of course. But that was never adopted. The other things were adopted. The inspections and, making sure the study of the metal and so forth. All of this was taken care of. So the Morrell did have some good came out of it, I guess, if you want to call it that. But unfortunately, it wasn't good for all those men that lost their lives.
No. And didn't the policies change as far as calling in overdue ships and that idea a better understanding of where's the fleet at now?
They were supposed to be doing that anyway, but it wasn't a law, so to speak. Hmm. People just did, that was they wanted to know where their boats were. And the Morrell did, the Townsend did, all of them called in. It's one of those things that is very hard to understand. In other words, the Morrell was in constant contact, running all the way through, but back and forth over the night with its sister ship. How's it going? What's going on? And Connolly, the captain of the Townsend was talking about how rough it was. It was blowing him way off course. He couldn't hold course. And he was thinking about going back. There is some evidence to suggest that the Morrell did the same, that the Morrell had turned around and tried to make it back to, Port Huron, where it was safe. But it didn't make it. And it really sank right about where he claimed he was, the captain, when he was talking to Connolly the last time they spoke. In other words, we know what happened, but it broke apart almost within minutes of when they talked.
Hmm. Sounds like a familiar story 10 years later. Now, how?
Yeah, I know it.
So,
well, we just had the anniversary yesterday of the Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
And, it was really, it's really sad, that in their case, nobody will ever know what happened. It was on the radio. The captain, McSorley, the Fitzgerald, was on the radio with a boat that was about 10 miles or so behind them. And they were in constant contact because the other boat was acting as the Fitzgerald's radar. The Fitzgerald had lost its radar in the storm. And the last time they spoke, the guy said, "Well, so how are you doing with your problem?" This is one of the things that happens on the lakes, too. Is nobody likes to say they're in trouble because everybody's listening in. All these people, they're like hobbyists. They listen in on all these calls.
Mm-hmm.
And so, how are you doing with your little problem? He didn't say anything other than that, even though the Fitzgerald had reported that it was listing and it was taking on water. And the captain of the Fitzgerald says, "We're holding our own." 5 minutes later, it disappeared from the radar.
Wow. Modest pride.
Yeah, but you never know. There was so much with that accident, too, that, you know, that now it really involves speculation, because there were no survivors. Nobody could say what really happened.
Yeah. It broke in two, but we don't know if that happened up top or down below. It's a great mystery. You're right, Michael. Now, here's something. Could any of this happen again? Or it seems like it's now 30, 50 years since we've had these disasters. What's changed in shipping that we no longer have this?
Well, and now you're asking me, or you want me to talk about the way the captains tell it. In other words, you know, I've talked to, I don't know how many captains over the years, and including some of them that are in these big thousand-footers now. You know, massive. You can't believe the size of these things. They're over 3 football fields long. And these guys will say, no, it can't happen again. Nope, it never would happen again. Well, my take on it is that, well, anything is possible. You know, don't ever tempt nature, because nature will win. Now, what we have today that they didn't have, you know, they've got, you know, radar, that you know, Doppler, that follows the weather patterns and the fronts and everything very, very closely. They could see a storm. Back in the days, you know, of some of these boats, they posted flags, for God's sake. You know, to tell people what the wind direction was, as if they couldn't tell already. But the communications is so much better today. The science is so much better today. It's very unlikely. You would have to be a fool to go out under certain circumstances. I know I live right near Lake Michigan. That's a 5-minute walk from my house. And I used to have a place right on the lake where I could watch, I'd go out on my deck and watch the waves, and those big nor'easters are blowing, and you get some real interesting water close to shore. And the only reason I mention all this is that, you know, if it looks bad close to shore, you can only imagine what it is in the middle of the lake, because the waves are breaking up by the time you get to shore. And so, you know, you have all of it in this weather that you're used to seeing, but now they know when it's coming in. They can seek shelter, or they can just stay in port, wait it out, where they're not putting anybody at risk. And I'm not trying to imply either that these captains were foolish. They certainly wouldn't risk their ships or their men's lives, you know, foolishly. There were some that were known as heavy weather captains, though, that would go out in a lot stronger weather than others. But be that as it may, it's hard to really sit and blame, you know, a ship's master for going out in a storm. They knew. The Morrell and the Townsend both knew that a bad storm was expected. Both ships took shelter the night before the Morrell went down. Both of them down near Detroit. They just, you know, dropped an anchor and waited it out. And the next day it looked a little bit better. So they thought they'd continue up. They would not have risked anybody's safety if they didn't think they had a good boat. The Morrell, it might be pointed out, was out in the same storm that took down the Carl Bradley, you know, in 1958. It knew something. It had survived some tough waters. And it had been inspected not once but twice in 1966, and it passed both inspections. It was getting old. You know, the boat was 66 years old, but it was seaworthy. You know, some people grumbled that it wasn't, but the fact of the matter is that this sounds terrible, but it's really the truth of sailing. You know how you know you've got a bad boat? It sinks. You know, I mean, that's the truth of it.
Too true.
If it comes through, then it's fine, isn't it? I've had sailors tell me about how they'd be down below decks in these riveted, the older riveted boats, and they'd be popping rivets like, you know, bullets were flying down there. And you know what they do with that? When a rivet came out, they'd stick a broom handle in there and saw it off. And it would hold until they got to port.
Yeah. Adapt. You know, so improvise, adapt, and overcome. We just talked about that last week with the Trellers. So, Michael Schumacher, mm-hmm. we've got to wrap it up. Torn in Two is the new book, the new read. It's really good. It's the sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and one man's survival on the open sea. Fascinating read, Michael. Torn in Two, it's out on University Press now, Minnesota University Press. And we appreciate all your insights and sharing a little storm shipwreck stories on a storm weekend here in Cook County and the gales in November. We hope they keep blowing.